Daily news out of the US tends to be Washington-centric, focusing on the latest incendiary tweet or pending trial. It's understandable, given the shock and awe tactics of the Trump administration. But what's getting lost are the longer-term consequences of America First, the challenges that poses to an international order underwritten by US military and political hegemony. Are we seeing the decline of the American century? And if so, what comes next? If the US pulls back from a role as a global policeman, who will step into the breach? Lawrence Whitehead is a senior research fellow in politics at Nuffield College, Oxford University, and Lawrence is in Australia to give a talk titled The Weary Titan, The Fading of the American Century. And I'm delighted that Lawrence can join us today on Late Night Live. Hello, Lawrence.
Hello there.
Lawrence, many analysts have sheeted the decline of US hegemony to the Trump administration, but in some ways his predecessor, Barack Obama, began that process of disengagement. Do you see a continuity between the two administrations?
Yeah, I think, as you said in your opening remarks, it's extremely tempting to get carried away by the immediate sensationalism of the Trump administration and not see these things in a longer-term perspective. Actually, a lot of the things that are shocking people about Trump today remind me somewhat of the time when I was first in Washington. I lived in Washington 1979 to 81. So I witnessed from fairly close up the transition from Jimmy Carter to Ronald Reagan. And it's not so different. I mean, clearly, we now remember Reagan in a very different way. But at that time, Reagan was, he was a film actor who was not, people did not know whether he was really competent as a politician. He was a right-wing figure who was repudiating all the liberal ideas of the 1970s. And the discontinuity between the two of them, between Carter and Reagan, was shocking to a lot of opinion, not only domestically, liberals in the US, but also quite disruptive and unsettling to quite a few of America's allies.
And you see that pattern being reflected similarly today. I mean, I suppose people have drawn that comparison between Trump and Reagan to some extent.
Yes, it's a comparison which is not intended to be overplayed. I'm merely saying, if we're standing back a little bit from the noise and drama of today, then it's useful to remember this isn't history. Does have a tendency to produce similar things over long periods of time. That's not to say that what Trump is facing is anything like what Reagan is facing. Mm. The consequences will not be the same. Mm. But actually, after a year and a half of Reagan, people were extremely unsure how that was going to pan out. And we're only in the first year and a half of Trump. It's been even more disturbing. You're quite right that he's made a very systematic policy of anything that Obama was doing, I want to do the opposite, and I want to do it in a big way. Mm. And that adds to the melodrama of it, and it obviously appeals to his base, people who were not happy under Obama.
Yes.
But underneath the surface of that, he's inherited a whole series of questions which are long-term questions about the United States, its place in the world, its relative strength, and those problems are long-running.
We've become very used to the US role as a global leader, in a sense, and find it difficult to imagine a world where it's no longer playing that role. But this idea of the American century is still a relatively recent one. It wasn't really until the 1940s that the US had moved away from an isolationist position.
I think that's true, and I think it's tended to get forgotten, especially by close allies like Britain and the Australians and so on of the United States, tended to interpret US position in the world through the lens of what you might call the East Coast elite, which had a very coherent and powerful set of ideas about how the world should be run, and was willing to, as I say, not just in the military field, but also in terms of political alliances and in terms of trade negotiations, in terms of the World Bank and so on and so forth, was willing to offer a more or less stable set of relationships to its partners, especially its preferred allies, which involved the US in taking some pain, making some sacrifices in the short run in order to stabilize the global system in everybody's, as they saw it anyway, in everybody's interest in the long run. Trump's position is that we have been taken for a ride by our allies, that we're paying too much for that, that they think we're suckers, that they expect us to overcompensate for their own failings. And what's more, Trump doesn't really like the traditional allies that the United States had. He is drawn to strong men who, you might say, were the traditional antagonists or rivals of the United States rather than the traditional allies.
Your talk draws a parallel between the fading of British power in the 19th century and the decline of the American century. You see similarities there. What are some of those similarities?
So we have to be careful. It's like comparing Reagan and Trump. It's useful when you're confronted with a particular situation to look for something else you can compare it with. But that doesn't mean things automatically repeat in the same way as before. So it seemed to me that if we're looking at the long run leadership role that the US played from the 1940s, and especially from 1989, and the problems that it's now running into, we need to cast the net wide to find comparable long-term processes. And there was a similar one, somewhat similar at any rate, Britain in the 19th century until the First World War. And the shock that came both to the British and to the rest of the world when that long Royal Navy and City of London and so on supremacy came to a startling conclusion. Mm. So there is a literature now, which is the academic term is the Thucydides trap. The Thucydides trap refers to a very ancient idea, namely that when Athens was in the ascendancy and Sparta was rising as a challenger to Athens's dominance, there was no way those two could hand over smoothly. And therefore you got the Peloponnesian War and everybody lost. Mm. And the question that's being asked is, well, now the United States is going to have to make way for a rising China. That's basically the analogy. Mm. In the same way, for example, that the British had to make way for a rising United States from the 20s onwards. Well, in the case of Britain and the United States, there was a handover. It wasn't smooth by any means, but it was possible gradually to move from a British-dominated international liberal system to a US-dominated, with a tremendous problems in the interwar period, of course. But it was possible to do that. And the question that poses now is, which of these analogies, the Peloponnesian War or the handover from Britain to the United States, is more relevant to the 21st century, which will not be the American century? I mean, demographically, it cannot be. The proportion of world population, the proportion of world trade, in fact, even in the military area where the United States is particularly in the ascendant,
but it will
a share of world's military spending and its capacity to control the world in military terms will be going down.
Absolutely, but it will remain, will it not, a superpower, perhaps not the world's biggest economy. I don't think it's the world's biggest economy anymore, but it will remain a powerful entity. And will American exceptionalism itself prevail even as America perhaps withdraws from the world?
Well, every country in a way is a little bit exceptional. Australia, I notice, has its own exceptionalism. The British always think that they're exceptional compared to the Europeans and so on. And in that sense, I'm sure American exceptionalism will prevail. And there are many things about the United States which are so distinctive that we can talk like that. The problem with American exceptionalism in the academic world was it meant you refused to compare the United States with anywhere else. And my argument is not that the United States is the same as everywhere else. My argument is that there are lessons and analogies, but that you have to actually look at the United States from a slightly different perspective, not so much from an inward-looking perspective as from a longer distance, a more comparative perspective, in order to find the at least partially informative parallels.
Mm. So China's leadership, and, you know, China is the anointed one as far as global leadership is concerned, and the Asian century is what we talk a lot about here in Australia. China's leadership have said repeatedly that they have no interest in economic, military or political dominance, but it would appear as an observer that that's exactly the direction that China is heading in. Do you agree?
Well, I use the analogy, you know, the rise of China and the relative decline of the United States. When Britain had its problems, the United States was not clear that it wanted to take over all the leadership role that the British had. They too would have said, you know, we'll concentrate on Latin America and we'll concentrate on our own affairs, and we don't want to get too entangled in very complicated imperial battles that are nothing to do with us. So it took a long time for the American elite to shift from a relatively regional or isolationist outlook to a full assumption of world responsibility. I actually think, from what I can tell, that the Chinese leadership has been quite energetic and thoughtful about the kind of things that it must take on. And in some areas has, obviously because of Trump, they see opportunities to step in and say, well, if nobody else is making this established system of rules work, we will come in and do our bit to make it work. That mustn't be exaggerated. By the way, China is not the only rising power. India would be another rising power. I don't need to tell you about Indonesia, and so on. In other words, it's going to be a more multipolar system. It's not going to be a single replacement. And we should also be a bit careful about China. I think China's transformation over the last 40 years is an extraordinary achievement, and I'm inclined to extrapolate it into the future. But I remember when in the 1980s, everybody said, Japan is rising, the United States is being displaced by Japan. There are underlying weaknesses and problems that could very much slow that down.
Yes, I think you're reminding us of the importance of having the historic long view here. Lawrence, a recent piece in the New York Times noted that China has vastly expanded its trade and strengthened military ties and built enormous infrastructure projects in parts of Latin America. This is a story that's largely gone under the radar. It's not discussed a lot in Australia, at least. Can you tell us, first of all, what do we know of China's plans in the region?
So actually, it's curious that the Australians are not particularly knowledgeable. If you say that, I believe you, but I didn't know that. Because in some ways, the situation, for example, of the Brazilians is a bit like the position of the Australians. We, in Brazil, there is a great natural resource base. There's the capacity to produce a big, strong agro-industry sector, which can produce huge amounts both of grain and of livestock and of tropical and of, you know, orange juice. We can list all the products, and iron ore, just like in Australia, which is surplus to Brazil's domestic needs. And the Brazilian economy, which was used to be focused entirely on Europe and then became partly Europe, partly the United States, now the largest partner for the Brazilian economy, the biggest outlet and the most growing market for them is China, because with the population of China and the rising standards of living and the lack of fertile land and the all the claims on their resources that their development is leading, Brazil is, in many cases, a marginal supplier of things that it needs from the rest of the world, and it needs secure delivery of those supplies. So a lot of the investments that the Chinese are making are really intended not so much as a commercial transaction between one business and another, but they're intended as a sort of state-led project of long-term engagement with a supplier or a variety of Latin American suppliers that they want to lock in, and they want to ensure will be there when they need them in the future.
Does the US view this as Chinese expansionism into Latin America, and to what extent have they been blindsided by this increase in investment in the region?
So under Obama, and I would probably say under all American governments until Trump, there was a recognition that, you know, We want China to prosper. We want China to grow. We understand that China should be international. We want China to do that in a peaceful way, and we want it to be done through market incentives and so on. But so long as all those things are going on well, there was an acceptance, and there was a recognition that this meant Latin America was gaining a certain degree of autonomy compared to the past from the United States. It wasn't as dependent as before on the United States, and it had an alternative outlet. And the US, there would be people in the US who didn't like that, but it wasn't a fundamental concern. It had its merits, its advantages for the US, because they didn't have to worry about a dependent or anti-US dependent subcontinent. Now things are changing. Mm. The story, I mean, I'll just give you one example because it's very short term and who knows how it's all going to unfold. Brazil is the world's largest producer of soybean. The United States is the other huge producer of soybean. So the Chinese need to import huge amounts of soy. The United States is engaged in a trade war against China. Therefore, the Chinese have imposed 25% tariff duty retaliation on American soy. That means, of course, that they have to buy much more South American soy.
Mm. Yeah, interesting. Your particular field of expertise is Mexico. We've just seen a change of government there. The new president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, commonly known as AMLO, has been in power now for a month. What do we know of his long-term plans regarding the relationship between Washington and Mexico?
Well, first, he hasn't been in our... He was elected on the 1st of July, but he doesn't take office until the 1st of December. So we're actually going through a very interesting period of negotiations between the outgoing and the incoming government. And there is a great uncertainty whether, during that period of negotiations, the Trump threat to leave NAFTA might come to an end. NAFTA being the trade agreement that unites the US, Canada, and Mexico. Trump actually got a great deal of mileage politically out of really embarrassing and humiliating attacks on the Mexicans and threats to Mexican national interests. Threats in the form, for example, of, tariffs against Mexican industry, which is extremely focused on the U.S. market, and on the expulsion of Mexicans from the United States, and on accusing the Mexican government of all kinds of things. So if we talk in general about Trump not being able to work with traditional allies, there could not be a more spectacular example where he's trying to ruffle the feathers of a traditional ally. Mexico has been a very useful ally to the US.
Mm.
And the outgoing Mexican government paid a price for that. So then AMLO's elected, and AMLO, in some ways, it's too early to tell how this is going to pan out. You know that Trump lurches from, ferocious denunciations and to very, very surprisingly amicable tweets. In fact, there's been mainly amicable tweets so far between Trump and AMLO. We will see whether that persists or not. But one of the factors that may enter into this is that López Obrador will be the president of Mexico for 6 years. That's the last 6 years that Trump, even if he gets re-elected for a four-year term, can be president. So in contrast to other countries, Trump needs to think, in the long run, what kind of relationship do I want to have with this man?
Mm.
He could choose an antagonistic relationship, and he could find that the retaliation, while terribly damaging for Mexico, would be harmful and disruptive for the US. Or he could make the judgment, I can work with AMLO, there are deals here we can cut, there are things that we have to finesse, and that if I work with Mexico, I will then have America in a stronger position in its relationship to, let's say, to China.
Mm, be interesting to see how those conversations pan out over the border wall
That, of course,
Mexico.
Is a big explosive issue.
Yes.
Just this week, although he's not saying anything bad about Mexico, Trump is telling the U.S. Congress, I will shut down the US budget on the 1st of October if you do not give me $25 billion to build the wall.
Yes.
The US Congress cannot, remember it's midterm elections in November, the US Congress, I do not believe, could conceivably agree to that. So what is the purpose of that threat? Well, that's to fire up his base for the November election, and yet the moment is going to come when either the threat is real or it's phony.
Indeed. Talking about just these things to Bruce Shapiro on our program last night. Lawrence, been great talking to you. Thanks very much for your time. Lawrence Whitehead is Senior Research Fellow in Politics at Nuffield College, Oxford University.